Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host, also the host of the television series Wing Shooting USA. You can catch us on YouTube and Pursuit Up right about now, getting ready for another run on Pursuit Channel starting first quarter. Interesting show in store for you. We're going to be debating, discussing, and otherwise parsing out the whole concept of sharing spots. Call it hot spotting if you feel that way, but I'm just looking at it as a way to be generous, helpful, and create a new generation of hunters. But we'll have that discussion with your calls. Already got a long line in the queue, and hope we can have more. We'll also learn a little bit more about the Brock Francais from a visit I made to the Grand Seal Lodge in Plankinton, South Dakota. All that plus the usual stuff, a public access tip, apropos of our discussion on the phone later, some hunting strategy and dog handling advice, the Upland quiz, and a prize. It's all coming up right here. But let me pull on your coat for a minute before we start in the first segment. I want to thank a certain friend of mine from our training group, Ben, for a good job taking care of one of the secret spots I sent you to and then showing me some more secret spots that I promised to keep that way. We found huns where the chuckers should be, quail where the huns should be, and then we found good friends. One just driving up the road stopped and had a beer with us, and then another one sitting in the cafe when we pulled in for dinner that night. Isn't that another great reason to go hunting? But first, a word from our sponsor, ESPAmerica.com. One of the things I learned several times while I was at Grand Seal Lodge was how important hearing protection can be. And interestingly enough, it worked for everybody there as well. I'll give you the backstory later on in the program, but remember right now that you can adjust the volume of these ESP America hearing protection devices. Plugs just plug. ESP allows you to hear your surroundings. All right, so here we are, racing to South Dakota to meet our mentor and mentee from the CZ USA Next Gen contest. These folks came all the way out from Florida to take Ben on his first hunt and acquaint Bruce with South Dakota for the first time in a long time. It all happened because Brad Boysen at Grand Seal Lodge was willing to host us and show off his rather rare breed, the Brock Francais. We had crappy weather on the day before the shoot. We had crappy weather on the day after the shoot, but Mother Nature cooperated with us and gave us everything we needed and more on the day we actually did have the cameras in the field with us. We are having an incredible time here at Grand Seal Lodge near Plankinton, South Dakota. Came here for a whole bunch of reasons. Our CZ USA Next Gen Youth Hunt was sighted here, and we just come off an incredible hunt with Ben and his mentor, Bruce. All sorts of great hunting there, and I think we'll start with that part of the conversation. I've got Brad Boysen here. Brad is the operator of the Grand Seal Lodge. Tell us how it went yesterday.
I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I enjoy nothing more than watching young hunters and young dogs cut their teeth on South Dakota pheasants.
Your grounds are incredible. I've told you before, anybody who's been to lodges in the past knows how rare it is that you can literally walk out the front door and go hunting. Everything's growing for the birds, and it shows in the results. We had incredible covey flushes on pheasants. We had lots of challenging pheasants. Tell me maybe what was the highlight of the day for you, Brad?
The highlight of the day for me hunting pheasants is always the dog work. But again, watching 16-year-old Ben on his first pheasant hunt. That was right up there with watching some awesome dogs.
You know, I know anybody else would have done it, but he was with me at the time, and we were walking through that shelter belt, which is kind of a Hall of the Mountain Kings kind of feeling if you can go there. And I pulled Tad, one of my camera guys, back, and I slowed back, and we just let Ben meditate as he walked through this incredible setting. And I think it kind of focused him a little bit, and then we hunted the rest of that, and then eventually we pretty much all laid back and let him go to a field all by himself with one or two dogs. And that was when the light bulb went off. Yep. It was, you know, this is the stuff you live for, folks. And while we've covered the whole idea of youth hunting and getting kids involved before, it's magical. And I encourage everybody, whether you're a parent or not, to find somebody like Bruce did who has expressed an interest and get out there and do it. Have you seen much of this? How do you get kids involved in the outdoors and in hunting in particular, Brad?
Well, out in South Dakota where road hunting is allowed, I've had several opportunities over the years. Several years back when the wild bird population was down, it's not uncommon to see what I would assume would be a dad and a son out there beating the ditches, trying to get a bird up in the air. And it's like, hey, how's it going? You stop and visit with them a little bit. And it's tough. You know, this is our last day of hunting. We got to head back to wherever we're from. And I said, well, I tell you what. I said, I got some birds here. Why don't you follow me? And I'll invite them down and I'll turn them loose in the, you know, near the tree belt, the nesting cover, the food plots, and let them have a shot at it. There's several years ago, I had an opportunity. And as it turned out, the guy was a retired Marine aviator who had been on three deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan and had given up, sacrificed a lot, but had sacrificed a lot of time with his three young sons. And I came across them and invited them out. And I said, look, I can't go out with you today, but I gotta turn the lodge over. But here's my book with my leases on it. And here, take this dog. He'll go find you some birds. They didn't have a dog. And to this day, we are best of friends. And they come back when their schedules allow. And the boys are growing up now. And it's harder for them to get the free time to come back. But Brian Whetstone and I are still dear friends, and he comes and helps us out.
You can't see this, of course, on a podcast, but both of us are smiling as wide as humanly, physically possible. As you were describing that, Brad, I was thinking about the times I've done similar things, spontaneous, off the cuff, just at the spur of the moment stuff that ends up being the highlight of the season. It really does. And I keep thinking about people who never do that and why they might never do that. And I'm trying to come up with a downside to taking a newcomer or inviting somebody along for the first time. I just can't. I mean, unless it's just pure unadulterated greed and you just want to kill every bird for yourself. I mean, am I missing something there?
I don't think so. I have found in my life, and coincidentally, it's my 61st birthday today.
So oh, I've had more happy than birthday.
Thank you. I've had more than a few birthdays, but over the years, I've learned, my wife always accuses me of oversimplification, but there's givers and takers in life. There's people that live in a universe of abundance, and there's people that live in a universe of scarcity. And I live in a universe of abundance. I'll tell you where my favorite fishing holes are. I'll tell you what I've used. I'll tell you exactly how many fish I've caught. I don't mislead.
Yeah.
I want to share. I want people to experience success. I want people to experience joy. And when you get that opportunity with a young person, I get so much more out of it.
Yeah.
Than the Whetstones did. And from their perspective, they would tell you that they gained a lot from from our interaction, but the joy I received is, you know, it's like the MasterCard. It's, how do you put a price on that? It's priceless.
You know, what's funny is I'm much like you. You've spoken like a true former chiropractor, by the way. Probably the most positive profession I've ever met. But beyond all that, it is still astounding to me that there are some people who think we're crazy to do that kind of thing, to be tipping people off to good spots, to be helping them become our competitors in the field or on the stream. I just don't get it. But end of editorial discussion. Good on you, and keep up the good work. Tell me, the second reason we're here is because you have a breed of dog that you're pretty darn proud of that's very rare, the Brock Francais. I've met a few, I've hunted with a few, but out here I hunted with two or three, Fred in particular, but Domino too, that were pretty eye-opening dogs for a number of reasons. Describe the breed.
Well, the Brock Francais breed, and rein me in because I will elaborate and expand. The Brock Francais breed, they believe, dates back to the 1200s. The first initial writings dated back to the 1300s. There's two types of Brock Francais. The larger breed, member of the breed is the Gascon. It's a 55 to 70 pound animal. It was the original Brock, and it is considered to be the common ancestor of all of today's modern short-haired pointing breeds. At the start of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1700s, when societies all over were beginning to industrialize away from the agrarian base, there was a transition from rural to urban. And they wanted to create a similar package and a smaller dog. And that led to the Brock Francais Pyrenees, which they were developed in the Pyrenees Mountains on the southern border of France and Spain. They're a lighter dog. They range about 40 to 55 pounds. And I tell you what, this dog has a gait that it's impossible to describe to a listening audience. It's something that you really need to see to truly appreciate, but they don't so much run as they kind of glide or flow through a field. And that gives them tremendous endurance. They have a very, very smooth gait is the only way to describe it.
Yeah, they are all-day dogs, no doubt about it. It'd be interesting to see a couple in the Chucker Hills somewhere, because I agree. I think that the gait is critical if you want an all-day dog or an all-week dog. Physically, describe them. I'm going to start with some shorthand. They look like a slightly more delicate German short-haired pointer in some respects. You're the aficionado. You take it from there and refine it.
Okay. Well, they do bear a resemblance. In fact, they're most commonly mistaken for small, calm German short-haired pointers.
No offense taken by the short-haired people.
I hope not. I had two GSPs, and they were wonderful, wonderful dogs. I enjoyed them both, but I had an opportunity in the early going on mid-1990s to investigate this new breed, and all I can tell you is that I was smitten from day one. What I read about them, and when I rolled the dice and got my first one back in early July of 1993, I found that everything I'd read in a very brief introductory gun dog article was true. And I remember reading that article and saying to Julie, my wife, gosh, if only half of what they're saying about this breed is true, it would be a really interesting breed to check out. So we did.
All right. So what did you read that got you so interested? I mean, somebody described that dog, that dog's attributes. What did you like before you even had one?
Well, and I'm going to qualify this. I had one of my GSPs had a companion dog temperament very, very similar to the Brocks. Very calm and easygoing in the house. And then I bought a second GSP from a friend of mine who had bred his female to a champion field trialer. And that dog had happy feet. He was wired 220 versus 110. And as much as I love the dog, he couldn't stand still to save his life. And that was back when our kids were toddlers. And I can't count the times that the you know, the dog was just being the dog, and he'd turn around and or come running into the room, and my son would go flying, and then he's crying. And, yeah. And so when I read the article, it described a small, calm, similar dog to a GSP, but naturally had a retrieve instinct and loved water. And both of my GSPs, despite their many fine qualities, did not appreciate water and were not inclined to bring a bird back to me. They'd go run down a cripple, but I'd have to go pick it up.
So I'll say biddability was an attraction to you in the broadest sense of the term. We're talking about all the stuff that we hate about some dogs or some dog breeds or a certain German wire-haired pointer that maybe you saw originally as a real attraction, natural biddability.
Correct, correct. And one of the requisites for me to own a dog is I want a dog that's going to be a good companion dog all year long. And that's one of the attributes of the Brocks that I truly and will always appreciate. They're phenomenal companion dogs. And then they step into the field.
Yeah.
Boom. They're in full mode to go find game. And
they're great house dogs. And I'm surprised we haven't got one right here right now, but there was one recently in here. Oh, right there.
Laying okay. On the rug right in front of the chair.
But you talk about this switch literally, you know, flipping a switch. We put them out in the field and all of a sudden they're a different dog in a good way. It's not Jekyll and Hyde. It's Jekyll times two, yeah. Maybe. But what do you think happens to these dogs that says, okay, now it's time to go to work?
I have no idea, but it can even be the evening before the hunt where you're getting your clothing and your firearms together and getting your ammunition all organized and getting ready to go, and the dogs are just starting to shake and the adrenaline starting to surge through their bodies and they're ready to go. They know.
Yeah.
They know the difference, and they just absolutely live for the hunt. They just absolutely inspired.
You know, Brock Francais on the Upland Nation podcast with Brad Boyson, who owns, what did we count last night? 7 total, I think, something like that.
7, and yeah. I got another female coming from France at Christmas.
Yeah, and by the way, there's a puppy in the building somewhere that may not be in the building very long, so be careful.
Do a head count.
Yeah, it's not a breed that you can just go down to the local dog club and see, let alone acquire. Tell us a little bit about the process of acquiring a rare breed like this and what you've been through and how we might want to learn more and possibly go down the same path.
First of all, and some of the more well-known breeders that have a presence and on the internet and on social media, they're scheduled out up to a year and a half, 2 years for their litters. And we've also started a club, Club Brock Francais North America, CBFNA, and I encourage anybody interested to check us out on our website or on our social media. But contact a breeder. I get calls every week for people looking to acquire a Brock. And I know many. I've helped a lot of breeders get started. I really want the foundation of this breed established the correct way. And we strongly encourage responsible breeding practices, and which requires orthopedic testing, eye testing. Confirmation testing is good. We want to maintain the conformational aspects of the breed as they are over in Europe. We want to continue that here. If this breed loses its conformation, if they're growing bigger and bred for more energy, they're going to lose their attributes that their conformation brings to them. So to us, it's very important to do that. But contact somebody. You can Google Brock Francais breeders, and there's going to be many that pop up. You can go to the website and on social media, we get inquiries there on our social pages. Every day, people looking for Brocks. And we do whatever we can to steer people to the responsible breeders.
You know, I hear this from a lot of folks, and even in the German dog world, we have North American branches of the European club, and we have European tests, and we have tests that are similar to European tests, and we bring German judges over and vice versa. And you guys are doing much the same thing in the Brock Francais world. And I know, of course, about the French Brittany world, Epagnol Breton. I'm going to get an email from somebody if I don't. We are all concerned about some fundamental basic things and preserving them. And you talked about conformation. So let's talk about what our worries are about Americanizing these continental breeds for the most part. Mm-hmm. And then let's talk about the hunting aspects of that. So let's start with conformation and tell me what might happen. For example, worst case scenario, what has happened to the American Brittany Spaniel, as they used to say, and how does that relate to the, you know, the Brock Francais?
Well, I don't know what it is, but it seems like, and it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, field trialers, and let me preface it by saying I do not mean to criticize anyone, any breeder, any other breed, but in America they tend to like dogs bigger and more energy in the field trial domain. The show ring people, I look at a classic example in my opinion is the English Springer Spaniel. If you look at how big and they're beautiful dogs, but the show ring Springer Spaniels have lost all their hunt. The Irish Setter, good luck trying to find one that has much of any field ability anymore. That's been bred out of them. And they're beautiful dogs. And so there's positives, but there's also some negative aspects if you look at it from the perspective of a person that wants a dog for hunting.
Yeah, and it becomes a real point of contention, of course. Some people think, well, we're just going to make it bigger and more beautiful. But if the dog's original job was to hunt, shouldn't we maintain that? And I ask that not rhetorically. Why not let those folks do what they want and let those folks do what they want and we'll do what we want? I mean, is there a downside to having a bench variety of a Brock Francais?
I look at it through the lens of a hunter, and so I'm not here to criticize anybody, and this is America after all, and I'm all about individual freedom and wanting people to make these decisions. So it's inevitable. We've been having a lot of conversations on our board for the Club Brock Francais North America, and it's just one of those things, and my input is very simply, look, the only choices we can truly affect are our own. And what we can do is be a resource to educate people that are looking at this from our perspective, through our lens. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to inhibit anybody, but I'm not going to encourage, and I'm probably not going to do too much to help.
There you go.
Other people that are looking to take this breed in a different direction.
We lament the fact that a lot of clubs like yours and mine we have test judges, we have international test judges, we test internationally, and we have breed wardens.
Yes.
Or somebody with a similar name. And that's where the rubber meets the road when it comes to preserving the breed as it is originally intended, isn't it?
It is. And we have used that very same terminology in some of our club calls.
So there is a way for us to maintain the character and the original intent of a dog. And it really, like you said, it gets down to individual choice.
It is. But in Europe, one of the things I truly appreciate, Scott, is that you could take your dog in as many field trials and qualify for as many championships as you want to pay for. However, if that dog does not pass confirmation, none of those field championships are allowed to be placed on their pedigree. And if they're not on the pedigree, it's as though they don't exist.
Wow.
So they marry confirmation and field ability together.
Amen. And we'll talk about that in a moment. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Brad Boyson. He's the proprietor of the Grand Seal Lodge. And just for the rest of us who needed a translator, that means Big Sky. Even though we're in South Dakota, they do have Big Sky. They had Big Sky yesterday, didn't they?
Beautiful Big Sky.
Brad is also an aficionado of the Brock Francais, probably one of the best ambassadors of the breed. when we think in America, quite often, and I don't be, I'm not a snob. I'm an American. Yeah, I can prove it. Confirmation means different things to different people. In the hunting side, confirmation is basically practical aspects of how the dog is assembled.
Correct.
Describe that to us for those of us who maybe only understand confirmation as the Shih Tzu on the bench on the Westminster Club TV show.
Sure. Well, in very general terms, when you look at a brock from a profile position, the top of the shoulders is called the withers, and what you want to take is that measurement with the legs front leg straight down underneath the dog, and then you want to reference a line from the back legs to the front legs. So you have the height and you have the length. You want that to be a box. You want that to be square. In a female, they do allow for up to a 5% longer length than height. And the reasoning for that is that they are the puppy bearers, and larger litters are produced with females.
Longer
have,
dogs, more
have
dogs.
A little bit longer wingspan. Yes. So, and then you don't want the butt bite. You want a nice scissor bite, you know, so the bite's important. And there's some things having to do with the head. If you take the ear and pull it towards the nose leather, you want approximately an inch from the tip of the ear to the nose leather. I mean, that's a very subtle.
Well, yeah, but, you know, at one point, all of this stuff mattered. There was a reason for much of this, and while we may not appreciate the reasons, we may not know that the angle of the stop needs to be a certain way and all, there are practical reasons for much of this, aren't there?
There are. And unfortunately, I am still learning.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been to France at several breed events over there, and I were just there this last summer in July, last weekend in July, we went to the breed event over in France, and I am still learning a lot. And I can't explain, and I think some of that, Scott, has to do with the language difference. But every year I learn something else, and I just try to be a sponge and learn as much as I can. But I still have a long ways to go. Although I am the longest standing breeder of the
wow.
Brock Francais Pyrenees in the United States, I still got a lot to learn.
Oh, so yeah, it would help if you parlez-vous français.
Un petit peu, just a little bit.
Très bien.
Not nearly enough.
Especially when it comes to dog talk, I'm sure. Take us to France with you do we call them trials, field trials over there? Do we call them hunt tests? Take us to one of those and
okay.
Tell us what goes on.
Well, they're field trials, and typically they're going to run a single dog or a double dog, two dog brace. And I tell you, they're similar. The field trials aren't rated or judged on like the person's ability to shoot and bring down a bird. If a bird is shot, then the dog is certainly judged on the retrieve and those types of things. But it's all on the dog work. It's not have anything to do with handlers.
Oh boy, I might have to try that then.
It is, and we've associated with the United Kennel Club, and they allow us as a breed club to hold the standard and to define the breed standard, which to us is important, of course, as we've already discussed. But they also allow us to create our own field trials.
Mm-hmm.
And we've mimicked the European model as closely as we can.
So what are the, let's take a young dog test over here. We have, depending on whose club you're in, it's a natural ability type of test.
Right.
Well, a young dog test. What are the components of that field trial for your breed?
In the UKC, they do a water retrieve, mm-hmm. And they do what's called a TAN, which basically the young pointer is going out and they're watching the dog search. And in order to pass a TAN successfully, they have to find and point a bird.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to hold the point.
Yeah.
And then they also have an open class, which the dog has to go out and search and find a bird. They don't have to be steady to wing till shot. or excuse me, that's the gun, mm-hmm. and then the open, the dog does have to be steady to wing till shot until the judge allows you to release the dog.
Okay.
And what I've learned on that one is that what you do as a handler is you go over, you flush the bird, shoot the bird, or if it's out of season, we do use training pistols, mm-hmm. So there's no retrieve. But we go through the whole motions, we shoot at the bird, and as soon as you shoot, you got your lead in your one hand, and it goes over the dog's neck, and you look back to the judge, and then they will give you permission to release the dog. You take the dog, you move it, you take it away from the flush of where the bird just went, you change their... get their mind off of that, and you take them in a different direction and re-release.
Sounds, you go again. Sounds familiar. No. We're lucky enough in our world, and actually, you should read this book because it probably helped you a little bit too. Bob Ferris, a friend of mine, has just written a book on basically how to pass the NAVDA utility test.
Wonderful.
And there's
we strongly do encourage NAVDA participation, at least natural ability. Yeah.
North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. Fantastic. We welcome, I think, 26 different versatile breeds in the group. And if you had a less common versatile breed, we'd probably let you in too. But there are some tricks of the trade when it comes to a field trial or a hunt test at any level that everybody ought to, you know, if you can't hang around with a whole bunch of great NAVDA trainers and judges, you buy the book and learn about that. Some of your dogs are coming all the way from France. Tell us, just for giggles, what is the general process? Now, first class Fred had quite the experience coming over here, but in a nutshell, you know, Reader's Digest version of bringing a dog from a foreign country, your experience involves what steps?
Well, it involved, we talked about mentorship with Ben and Bruce. I've been so blessed. And again, I've been importing. I imported my first dog in September of 1994, and I worked through a gentleman, Michel Gelinas, up in Quebec, who was, I have to credit Michel, he is the one that brought the first Brock Francais to North America that we're aware of, at least in modern history. And we have a high level of thanks and gratitude to Michel for doing that. I worked through him for a few years, and then I started working with another gentleman up in Quebec, and that led to me meeting one of the vice presidents of the Brock Francais Club over there, Ange Frankie, and he is now not only my primary dog contact in France, he is our children's adopted, he and his wife are our children's adopted grandparents and vice versa, they're adopted grandchildren, and so we've become very, very close with Ange, and my process is I call Ange. And not only for my own dogs, but I have helped many other people import dogs from Europe. And I call Ange, and he runs breeding coefficient. He has software, and they're available to anybody that wants to do that. But he runs them on the Brocks. I don't know of another human being, maybe Pascal Gassio, the president of the Brock Club, who we're also dear friends with now. And Pascal is big time into both the Pyrenees and the Gascogne, and so I've had several requests here over the last several years to import Gascogne, and so I've been privileged to help bring some of those bigger brothers or cousins to the mm-hmm. to the Pyrenees over. But it basically involves contacting them, and mm-hmm. they know the breeders, they know the different lines, and they know so much more about it than I ever will. That basically starts the process. They beat the bushes, they find the right dog, run the software programming to spits out the breeding coefficient, and we're trying to maintain a level of genetic diversity. Yeah. Is the reason for that.
You talk about in every continental breed, and probably in the British Isles too, you got to know a guy, and maybe more than one guy, and the real challenge becomes knowing what you want that guy to do for you. And you talked about the breeding coefficient, and you got to have a level of trust in a person like that, because number one, they got to speak the language. Number two, they got to have your best interests at heart. And finding that person is maybe the biggest challenge. If I didn't know you and I wanted to buy a Brock Francais from France, What's your first bit of advice?
Oh my.
Should I join the club?
I would join the club. Yeah. I get contacted all the time for people wanting dogs domestically, for people looking to import. And I just do whatever I can, however I can serve and help help people.
Yeah. And it, you know, it,
so contact me. Contact somebody in the club.
Yeah.
We'll do whatever we can to help that process along.
And I'll often advise people to join a club, whether it's a breed club or a training club, before they own a dog, so that they can see how that all works and see if they're up for the commitment and all of that. Plus, it's a great way to shop different breeds, especially if you're in a NAVDA group, for example, or even a NASTRA or anybody else. We've been talking around the subject a little bit, and it's time now to get down to the nitty-gritty. What is it about dogs that trips your trigger?
Oh, unconditional love. Mm-hmm. I tell you what. We're all supposed to strive to be doing that. Dogs do it.
Yeah,
they cannot not do it. And, you know, they're just phenomenal about that, and they help me to align myself properly. And I just appreciate that so much about them. They're all about unconditional love.
You know, they are the best reminders in the world. You can't. There's no app for that. That you need a living, breathing reminder of. The positivity in the world.
There you go.
And they've got it, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And you like your breed because of certain aspects of that, and I like mine for certain other aspects of that. And we have a Wiesel owner over there, and we have no idea why he owns that breed, but he loves them too. We all have reason, but they all boil down to something intangible, don't they?
Something resonates inside of a dog owner about a particular breed, and it just works for them.
Yeah.
And there's attributes, positive attributes in every breed. I love them all. I just love some more than others.
Yeah. And yo también, the same thing. What do you think makes us move towards a certain breed? I know what I fell in love with that face.
Oh.
Sure. Because I'm just I'm a troublemaker, and a dog that looks like a troublemaker is right in my wheelhouse. But, you know, at some point you just saw a dog and you said, that's the one.
Well, like I say, back in early July of 1993, Julie and I decided we were going to acquire a Brock.
Yeah.
And I tell you, from that point on, I figured out early on, my first hunting dog was an English Springer Spaniel, and she was a wonderful, wonderful dog. And of course, labs are ubiquitous in the part of Minnesota where I was raised in. And if you didn't have a lab, you typically had a GSP. And I was just looking for something a little different, something out of the ordinary. And what I found was extraordinary. It's everything I wanted. I did find myself drawn to the pointing. I mean, I have British labs because we have a pheasant hunting business, and we have to do a certain amount of our hunting in row crop. Mm-hmm. I don't think row crop is the right place for a pointing breed. I'm drawn to the pointing style of hunting. I like the way the dog matches wits with the game, and they get after it, and they got to get close enough to pin that bird down, but not too close that they cause it to run or to fly. But just watching that process unfold, you can tell when they catch scent and they start working the bird, and then game on, and then it gets the heartbeat going a little bit, and it's just, to me, it's just so exciting, and I love it. And this, I have found that the Brock Francais Pyrenees is the perfect dog for me.
I love it, and I will. Indelibly etched in my mind is an opening between, I think it was Milo and some CRP, and there happened to be a fuzzy-faced German dog at the far end, and he was locked up. And then we had a back from both of your dogs, and it was a United Nations of dogs. Don't we wish everybody could get along that well?
Yes, it is.
Good. Well, Brad, it's been a pleasure staying here. It's been a pleasure watching these dogs work. Thank you for having us. If you'd like more information on Grand Seal Lodge, what's the website address for you guys?
It's GrandCielLodge.com, GrandCiel Lodge, LODGE.
And you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Brad Boyson, and we'll see you next time. We're just getting warmed up, and all the calls are coming through for our next discussion on sharing your hunting spots, so stick around for that. Also, check out the Facebook page. I'll be looking at that as we go and monitoring your comments there as well. Before we get to the calls, I got to give you a little backstory here. This is the whole reason for this part of the show and all the debate online and, well, in our own heads, too. A few weeks ago on a certain Facebook page, a certain administrator of that page called anybody who shares their hunting spots with somebody an idiot. I took offense, as did any number of other people who I know for a fact aren't idiots. In my case, maybe I am. You be the judge of that. But it got to the point where, it was getting less than civil. Let's leave it at that. So I thought I'd invite all the civil people out there, since the others won't participate, to join in on the discussion. I know there's a lot of nuance in there, and that's what I hope to discover as we go to the phones. So our first victim, if you want to call it that, is Troy Stark. Troy, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Oh, I'm well, Scott. Thank you.
And I mean that in the best possible way because, everybody who comes on something like this risks a little bit of exposure, if you will, and I appreciate you're coming on to talk about it. You know, you mentioned in your note to me that you've done a lot of, I guess I'll just call it recruiting in our world, and so you have some very strong feelings about whether you should show people some of your spots or not. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Well, sure, Scott. Yeah. In my life, I've had a number of jobs, and one of my jobs, I worked at a health club. And at that point in my life, I realized that I enjoyed bringing new people along for new experiences. And that included hikes. It included mountain bike trips. It included climbing trips. And so when it comes to hunting, it's the same sort of thing. And I just feel like we need to stick together as hunters. And if we have more people coming along, that's just better for the sport. You know, I don't feed my family with what I hunt. And I don't, if I go out and have a good day with a couple of new guys and introduce them to something, they have a good time. I mean, that's really, it's the camaraderie that is really kind of critical for me.
Well, I can't argue that at all. I would also suggest, and maybe you've given that some thought as well, you know, if we don't start bringing other people into this sport and they don't stay in the sport because they're a little bit successful, then all of a sudden we got nobody paying the excise taxes or buying the licenses or joining Quail Forever and Pheasants Forever. Is that a part of your ulterior motive?
Well, It kind of works this way. So I have two teenage boys, and my oldest boy was involved heavily in sports. And when he was younger, I coached a lot of teams, and I saw that there's a lot of young kids out there that really don't get to see much beyond a screen and their school. And now he's a little older. He's off in college. My other son, he loves to go. And then getting those other boys that are around, that maybe from the church youth group or maybe from school, that don't have the opportunity to get up in the morning and head out and follow a dog. That's something that I think is really, really important. I mean, it's multi-pronged, Scott. It's the hunting aspect and the keeping the kind of the numbers going, but then it's also what it does for someone's heart and soul. Just to get out in the woods and to follow a dog is just outstanding. And so you can't, it's part of it. Yeah.
Well, you sound like a great ambassador, and you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what brought me into the sport was the dogs and then wanting to share that incredible work with other people. I get to do it on TV. You're doing it out there in the field as well. Do you see any downsides to sharing some of your spots with people?
Well, when you go out there, and I'll be real honest, I like to go to new places, but I tend to go to a lot of the places that I feel comfortable with. And again, it kind of rides through a priority list for me. It's like, okay, why am I going out here today? Well, I've got my brother-in-law along, and I've got a neighbor down the street who, you know, he's never ever gone bird hunting. And so here's what we want to do. I want to go someplace where it'll be challenging, but it's not going to be arduous. They're not going to not want to do it again. And so I'm going to take him someplace. Hey guys, the last time we were here, you know, we saw X number of birds and we got this many, and this is how we did it. So let's just go out and let's see what we can do. To be honest, Scott, I don't necessarily think too much about whether or not they're going to be successful. I don't take them away from where I've had success. I try and take them to where they're going to be successful. But in all honesty, the most important thing to me is A, that everyone is safe, and B, that they don't shoot my dog.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would advocate for that. And I know for a fact that you have a great dog, comes from a great kennel with a great trainer breeder. And so I understand completely. The thing that I'm guessing, we'll see as we get through the calls here and some of the Facebook comments, but I'm guessing that a lot of people are afraid. Let me put it the diplomatic way. They're afraid that if they share too much, somebody's going to go there and they're going to shoot out the spot, or they're going to trash the spot in one way or another, or they're going to tell the rest of the world and those people will shoot out the spot or trash the spot. Does that ever enter your mind when you're bringing your friends and your neighbors along?
You know what? No. But what does enter my mind is that I surround myself with, and I share these opportunities with guys that I care about. Mm-hmm. And so, I work in commercial real estate, and there's a lot of testosterone driven guys in that world. I don't share these experiences with them. I just don't. They're scorekeepers, and that's not what I'm after. I share it with the guys from the church, and I share it with my neighbors whom, you know, I go shrimping with and I go crabbing with. And then it's like, hey, you know what? Our kids are friends. Why don't you come on over? Let's have a drink. Let's sit on the deck and let's talk about what we can do. That's how I do. So I make the delineation kind of before that point. I don't think about, okay, are they going to go shoot it out? No, I know these guys. I have a sense for who they are, and I have a sense for their conservation ethic, and I respect that, and I don't invite anyone that doesn't kind of, you know, not fully see eye to eye with me, but who is more in alignment with me.
I get it completely. Love it. Good luck with the dog. Hope you have a great season. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast, Troy.
Scott, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Troy's point, well taken. Here's one from the Facebook page. Along the same lines, Jack Reynolds says, I vet people very carefully about my spots. I've carefully kept a detailed journal and marked spots in my walk-in area map and what's there. Found spots years ago that are still in the program, and I still return every year. I also have private spots I have permission on, etc., etc. Well, I get that, but he's totally against what some people are calling hot spotting and sharing specific spots. His point, and not uncommon, if you're not willing to put in your homework, then perhaps paying a guide or buying a preserve hunt is your best option. That doesn't really answer the question, though, but we'll go back to the phones and see. Okay, a little bit of a different perspective, I believe. Andy Cooper joins me on the line right now. Andy, you say you're the administrator of a couple Facebook groups where you have rules against hot spotting. First, just for everyone's benefit, define hot spotting as you see it.
Hot spotting to me is posting of specific areas or locations where, you know, birds are being, in our case, birds, right? But it could be upland birds. It could be ducks or deer or any game animal that might draw additional hunters or an overwhelming number of hunters in some cases to a specific area.
Okay, so the internet is critical to this hot spotting then, am I correct?
I would say in some cases, yes. You know, in the past, I don't think it was necessarily even as much of an issue. You know, the only hot spotting that really happened in the past is if some, you know, a writer in a magazine or a newspaper might have given away your spot. But now with social media and in the near past, right, with the bird dog forums, it's become a bit more of an issue.
Now, you said something that really piqued my interest there. You said giving away your spot, meaning
right.
My spot or your Andy's spot. Are we talking about private ground that we would be trespassing on, or is this public property?
Yeah, I guess my spot would be, you know, a spot that I've found or a spot that you've found. Uh-huh. Now, hot spotting isn't typically an issue on private ground, right? That's not something we even consider typically. We understand that most people don't trespass. Mm-hmm. You make a very valid point in that case. It's not my spot. It's a spot I found, but it's our spot, whether it be BLM or, you know, wildlife management area or walk-in hunting or whatever the case may be. It's definitely a public spot.
Okay, so on your Facebook groups where you have rules against hot spotting, what is the rationale for those rules?
So I think, if I can just explain a little bit there, I think it's looked at in many cases where it's that we don't want to help new hunters. And I think that's a negative connotation that comes along with the anti-hot spotting rules. But it's not the case. It's we want to help new hunters. In the groups that I'm part of, we encourage people to help new hunters. We just ask them to do it privately. You know, some of the groups have, you know, as many as 20,000 members, right? And not everybody there needs a spot, but they are always there watching and looking for these easy places for them to be able to go find birds. And it can overwhelm some public areas. It has overwhelmed some public areas.
So if we change the word from hot spotting to careful and diplomatic pre-vetted sharing of spots on a limited basis outside of the internet, you're okay with that?
I absolutely encourage people to share spots, take new hunters, encourage people to go. You know, local knowledge is hard to come by if you're not local. I've absolutely benefited from local knowledge from guys where I've gone out of state and people have helped me. And I try to do the same for people that are either going somewhere to where I'm going. Like, you know, I spent a lot of time in Wyoming last year. I have helped lots of people who are planning to go to Wyoming with some local knowledge that I learned from boots on the ground. But I live in Oklahoma, and I also encourage people to come to Oklahoma, hunt our public grounds, I give them all the tips that I can, but I do it on a one-on-one basis, not in a publicly available group to 20,000 people or more who, you know, some of those folks may or may not need spots. But I'd say helping one or two guys doesn't overwhelm an area, but, you know, it can overwhelm if it's just out there for the public.
Well,
in my opinion.
Okay. And I get it. And it really does make sense when you explain it that way. You know, I'm one of those guys who's just the opposite. No, I'm not going to give away the latitude and longitude on any place, but even on this program right here, I've already told people where to go on the Black Rock Desert, for example. But, what I'm wondering is, have you ever seen the results of what I'll call a hot spotting gone bad? I mean, have you ever gone to a place that that has been overrun by hunters or trashed by hunters? You have.
Well, not trashed. I wouldn't say that I've ever seen a place that was trashed. I have seen some places that had a fair number of traffic or a fair bit of traffic from hunters. Just that have gone out and explored, found a location that was good by putting time in. And I've seen people talk about it online, and going forward from there, you know, the number of hunters, I couldn't put a number on the increase, but it goes from seeing a few guys, you know, that are hunting an area that's 2,000 acres to seeing 20 to 25 plus guys at the same place, all trying to fit in and hunt the same area.
Do you know that those guys were hot spotting or what?
It's anecdotal. It's anecdotal, okay. Right? I'm saying, you know, I've seen it talked about online, and then the traffic definitely increased. It might have increased anyway. I can't say for sure. But that's, you know, some of the areas that that we have here, some of the public hunting we have in Western Oklahoma is some of the best, some of the best public land quail hunting that you can get. And if any of, you know, if these areas are talked about in specifics, you definitely see an increase in traffic in those areas. And when I say specifics, it could be a Facebook group, it could be a, you know, a newspaper article, but it definitely drives increased traffic to these areas, in my experience.
Okay, well, that's a good point, and I get it. And I probably could have solved a lot of this problem by simply not using the word hotspotting when I went on some of these Facebook pages and stirred up so much, you know what?
Well, that's the catchy term that people like to throw around, though, is the hot spotting. You know, in some of the groups that we talk that I'm involved in, we also don't allow cold spotting. You know, cold spotting being like, this place was terrible, don't go there, right? We don't want to discourage people from getting out and trying to find new areas to hunt. I absolutely encourage it.
Well, good for you, and I hope you're going to do it again real soon, because if we don't, then we're going to have nobody out there doing it. And that means no money for the environment, the habitat, the management of the species, or anything else. Appreciate your comments, Andy. Just for the record, what kind of dogs are you running?
I run German short hairs.
Could be worse. Could have a beard and eyebrows.
I've run about everything in the past, and currently I'm strictly with German short hairs. So.
And how's your season going?
Our season actually hasn't started yet. Oklahoma quail opens this weekend. We're actually going to Kansas. I'm going to go take advantage of some of that local knowledge I've been given in the past. We had an early season, late September, early October hunt in Montana that we had some interesting weather to deal with, but we had a good time. And I got to take my father along with me, so we had a good time hunting new areas and covering new ground. So.
Well, I'll see you in Western Kansas if you're passing through. I'll be in Osborne, and I'll be in the Dodge City area. So safe travels to you. Take care of those dogs, and thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for allowing me to join you. I appreciate it.
And here's another comment from our Facebook page. Craig Armstrong says, I want other hunters to succeed, and I'm willing to give advice on habitat to look for or possibly different ways to hunt during certain conditions. I will help any way I can, but I draw the line at giving up locations, most that I've found myself, and yes, worked hard to put many miles on tires and feet. Well, Craig, I wish you'd come on the show with us, because what if nobody could do that? What if somebody has limited time, limited abilities, or any other limitations, if you will, and you're the only guy who can help him? Why can't you clue him in on just one or two spots? Anyway, food for thought, Craig Armstrong. Next up in the queue on the phone is Harry Hill. Harry, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How about yourself?
No complaints at all. Okay, for the record, my mini survey, what kind of dogs you running these days?
English Cocker.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. And because I love a certain shade of English Cocker, tell me what color you got.
Nice. She's a red.
Nice. My favorite. Good for you. All right. Well, have a good season. Let's talk about this idea of sharing spots, which as we go through the phone calls, I'm learning is slightly different than hot spotting. And I get it. And I'm just interested in your opinion. You volunteered to share your perspective. Tell me a little bit about what you do or don't do when it comes to sharing spots with people.
If I'm taking someone from out of town, I take them to my good spots. If I'm taking someone who's local who hasn't shared any spots, I take them to places where there's quail, but they aren't necessarily great spots. You have to hunt for the birds, work harder. Just because people I've shared good spots with that are local, go back to them and kind of shoot up all the birds. So I haven't been so generous with locals.
Is it because you just picked the wrong people?
Oh, probably. People have a tendency to ask you to take them hunting, and if they aren't willing to share their spots with you, if they're just asking for you to take them to places, they have a tendency to go back and share them with other people. And that wouldn't even be so bad if they called me and asked me to go with them, but they don't. They take other people and shoot up my spots.
I know quid pro quo is a big term these days in the political circle, but it also works for hunting, doesn't it?
Sure, sure. You want some balance there.
Have you seen any? Go ahead.
Go ahead. The thing is, you can shoot up a covey of quail pretty fast if you get a bunch of guys on it, and takes them a long time to recover.
I understand.
So here in the West, you work hard at keeping the coveys in good shape.
So it's a conservation thing as much as anything else. Yeah, I mean, it's not the fact that some other guy is going to be there. It's the fact that that guy may not have the same conservation ethic you have.
Correct, correct. They seem to think that if they find a covey of quail, they just keep working it until it's no more. And that doesn't work with valley quail.
I remember hunting with a professional turkey guide once, and he had the same basic philosophy. If you're from 1,000 miles away, I'll show you the good spots because I doubt you'll ever come back. But if you're within driving distance, it's a little bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I found, yes.
Well, is there anybody that you would take everywhere all the time? I mean, a family member, close friend, your wife, or anybody else that gets a pass no matter what?
My son and grandson. I'll take them any place I hunt.
And hopefully the apples didn't fall far from the tree?
Right. They pretty much learned from me, my ethics, so they pretty much hunt with the same idea.
I'm looking at your area code now, and I'm thinking you're down there where I want to be about January 10th. What's the bird situation looking like for you down there?
Lots and lots of birds. We had four hatches in some areas this year.
Wow.
On the dove opener, I saw four different generations of quail.
Wow.
And I was just out last Saturday for about an hour. It's too warm right now.
Sure, yeah.
It's over 70, and it's hard on the dog. But I put up a covey of probably 50 birds in no time at all. But the thing is, they run up the mountain, and I can't run as fast up a mountain as they can.
Okay, be careful. Don't start naming mountains, not on the podcast at least. But
I'll be calling
you come January.
Sure. I'd be happy to take you.
Thank you very much. And someday I hope to be able to take advantage of that. In the meanwhile, though, have you ever seen the result of what we'll call hot spotting, where a place, have you personally experienced that in any of your places?
Yes, and unfortunately in three or four different places.
Mm-hmm.
People I thought I could trust, and then they just wiped out the whole coveys.
And that is that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I promise never to do that. This year I've maybe you're already there, but I'm still evolving in this world. But I've decided I'm going to take one bird out of every covey flush, and that's if I'm really lucky and a good shot. And then I'm going to move on to the next covey. I know that it is not an original idea, but I'm thinking that might help in a lot of ways.
Well, it depends on the coveys, too. If you're hunting huge coveys, like some places out in the desert, you'll put up a covey of 100 birds or more. And a covey that size can take two or three birds taken out of it without stressing it too much. And you can go back in a couple of weeks and hunt it again. But if you see them getting down to 10 birds and it's getting cold, they're going to have to survive the winter. You don't want to stress that covey down to nothing.
I get it. All right, let's get back to the subject again for a moment, because I'm wondering if anybody has ever shared with you their spots and expected something in return, and if so, what was it?
I've had people share spots with me, and I don't go back to them unless they specifically say, hey, I'm not hunting this area very often. Go ahead. And then I'll take them to my spots. Same thing. No one's ever said, I expect you to return the favor,
mm-hmm.
but you do out of respect to them sharing something with you.
I'm seeing an ethic developing here that I will write down at some point and share with everybody and get comments on that, as well as this whole subject which we're exploring now. But it sounds like to me, advance notice, if you will, or a little bit of negotiation is a good way to solve a lot of this, a lot of the problems that are associated with sharing spots. Does that sound like, it sounds like that's what you do.
Sure. Sure. And unfortunately, sometimes you find people make big promises. They can't back up. They, you know, they say, well, I'll take you to my hunt club and put you on pheasants and chuckers, and then you never see them again. But then you find out they're up there where you took them and hunt, putting a lot of pressure on it. But for the most part, you try to deal honestly with people. You tell them, look, this covey can only take so much pressure, and there's other guys hunting it, so be careful out here. And you hope they honor that.
There you go. That word again coming up, honor. What a concept.
Yeah.
Harry, great to talk with you finally. I know we've tried to connect in the past, and I appreciate your taking the time. And yeah, look out, if I ever get a hall pass for January and I don't have to be at three different trade shows in 4 weeks, I might be calling on you. Thanks a bunch for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
You bet, Scott. And anytime you're in Southern California, give me a call and we'll try to chase down some quail.
Thank you so much. And a couple more from the Facebook page. Bob Crane says, I think it's called hunting. Yeah, let's not get snarky, Bob. You know, go out and hunt locations, conditions, game. You want to be led around for easy pickings, go to a game farm. Well, that explains everything. Bob's from Australia, where they got an attitude anyway. By the way, Bob would not go on the show as well, but that's his problem. People do need help, and if we expect there to be a hunting population in 20 years, we're the ones who are going to have to do the helping. One of the main reasons we're losing hunters is they are not seeing success. And if we can help them with that, maybe through a little bit of advanced negotiation, then maybe that's the way we do it. All right, so, you know, this is an interesting topic, rife with nuance and detail and another perspective. Jerry is in central Montana, operates a small motel there. Didn't stay there the last time I was in town, but I didn't know about you, Jerry, but welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
You're in Conrad. What's the name of your operation?
I own a small motel. It's called the Northgate Motel. Pretty small. We have 7 rooms at the motel, and I have 4 fully furnished houses, anywhere from 2 beds up to 5 beds.
Love that area and hope to be back again soon. You are dealing with hunters all the time, and the topic is sharing hunting spots. You have a different perspective than a lot of people on that because, you know, the happiness of your customers may well rely on their success in the field, if you will. So how do you handle people who are asking for suggestions on where to hunt?
Well, fortunately for us in the state of Montana, the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has done a pretty good job of providing property, whether it's state property or landowner property, for opportunities to hunt on. We have like 3 programs, the block management program, and then there's a open fields program, and an upland bird enhancement program is the other one. So there's a lot of places like that for guys to go hunting. But if guys come new, if they're new, and they come and they want to know where to hunt, I try to give them direction to a couple of the block management areas that are popular. Definitely ask them how their mapping situation is. Mm-hmm. The electronic mapping situation is very, very helpful nowadays. Rather than you can be driving down the road and everything comes up on your phone, or you can take your tablet with you or whatever, and it all shows up on that. And the other thing I tell them is not to be afraid to knock on doors. don't pull in a farmer's yard with three vehicles and six guys and knock on their door, because your chances go down dramatically. But most of the landowners around here are very generous with their property. And also the landowners around here, they kind of self-manage the bird population too. They do a pretty good job of it. If they're not seeing too many birds, they kind of slow things down a little bit.
Sure. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I understand all of that, and it all makes sense. You mentioned something earlier that I read in your note to me before, and that is, you say, what I do care about is the tradition of upland hunting and respecting landowners. If you're sharing a spot here or there, you see that as part of carrying on the tradition?
It depends. It kind of depends upon who I'm sharing the spot with. I'm a sucker for a guy that shows up with a with a young man or a young woman that wants to go bird hunting, and they have the dog, and it's just, you know, just mom and dad and their kids. I'll share a little bit more information with them than I would normally. However, I'll also explain to them that, you know, they're my spots, and I want them to respect my spots and respect the landowner's place, and you are an invited guest on that spot.
Yeah.
You know, the tradition part of it, Scott, is just, it's pretty amazing. How many of those, just the guy, even if it's just a group of guys, like the six guys that I was talking about, I mean, it's just a tradition thing for them. Of course they want to get birds. They, you know, they're not out just taking their gun for a walk. They want to shoot birds too, but it really is. It's a tradition for them to come here once a year or twice a year, whatever it might be. And, you know, they spend time together, and whether they've worked together in the past, or if they're just good friends, or if they're brothers, you know, and they're coming with dad or whatever, it's just interesting how you know, this upland bird hunting brings those guys together. Deer and elk hunting might do the same thing. You know what I mean? If they go to elk camp and they all camp out at the same spot, it might do the same thing.
Sure.
But I don't do that. I'm more into the bird hunting part of it. So it's really interesting to see that in the generations. It's just cool to see those three generations. I got four generations coming next year. The youngest won't be able to hunt, but there'll be four generations of family. They're going to come and just enjoy being here and taking the dog out, and kids will be yelling at the dog and they won't get any birds.
Yeah. That's the carrying on the family tradition, I guess. And you gotta learn yeah. somehow. Well, good. Yeah. Another perspective from a part of the country I wish I could live in, except during January and February. Jerry, thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
You bet, Scott. Good talking to you.
And one more Facebook contribution from John Treiner, who points out that in the last 30 years, while the population has grown, the small game hunter numbers are less than half what they were in 1991. Yeah, and how much of that? Well, we know for a fact from my surveys, among others, that the biggest challenge is finding places to hunt. And if they can find them by asking their friends and their neighbors for a little bit of help in that area, hey, what'll happen next? Everything good and possibly a little bit of risk. John points out that there's a balance there between being helpful and giving away your spots. But he makes another really interesting point we haven't had yet on the podcast, and that is, how many acres of upland habitat do you suppose the natural resources agencies would be leasing for us through a walk-in program, for example, if the numbers of hunters don't support their effort? Zero. John says, excited, successful hunters, new and old, keep the sport alive for all of us. Remember, in the long term, the sport needs participants. Amen to that, John. Okay, I think we got one. Let's see. We might have time for one more phone call. And that final phone call comes from yet another Facebook page administrator with a slightly different attitude, I think, than some of the others. Mark Grinstead, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be on.
You're the president of the Snake River Quail Forever chapter. You're also the admin for the Northwest Upland Hunters Facebook page. And you say you do share your hunting spots. I'd love your input.
Yeah, Scott. You know, it's, I'm not sure. I've just been sitting aside waiting on the call, so I haven't been listening to the show, but I apologize. I'll go back and listen to the whole thing. But you know, I don't put stuff out on Facebook or stuff like that as far as a location or something. But anytime I have an opportunity to introduce a new hunter, or for that matter, even a seasoned hunter to new birds. I had a friend of mine come up, visit last year, hadn't killed a chucker. You know, I put him on chuckers and huns last year. Just this past weekend, I had a friend of mine come up from California, who's also with Quail Forever, drove all the way up from California. I wasn't even able to actually hunt with him, but I carried him out to one of my really, really good spots. And I put him on, he called me that afternoon and, you know, they were on five coveys of chuckers. He said somewhere near 80 birds they put in the air. So,
okay. Well, off mic, you'll give me the latitude and longitude, won't you?
Sure, I will.
but that is one of the ongoing themes I'm hearing is there's a difference between telling the world, whether you write a magazine article or you put it on a Facebook page, and telling a good friend who you know you can trust and hopefully will carry on the same traditions and ethics that you do when you're out there. Now, just for fun,
right?
Who introduced you to hunting spots that have worked out?
Well, I'm a Georgia boy. I live in Idaho, but yeah. I'm a Georgia boy. I've been out here. This is Idaho's home now. I've been here 10 years. And,
you sound like you're from Southern Idaho.
Exactly. But actually, I grew up hunting quail in Georgia, and so I moved out to Idaho. Never had upland hunted out here before. And a good friend of mine worked at Sportsman's Warehouse. And I said, you know, hey, man, I've never killed a chucker before. I want to go chucker hunting. Well, he carried me to Hell's Canyon chucker hunting for the first time. And I'm 60 at the time. I was probably 62 or so years old. I'm 67 now. And I thought to myself, if I get off of this mountain alive, I'll be lucky. But I had a great time. We did kill some birds. And you know, it just, you know, again, you know, a friend, you know, is who introduced me to chucker hunting.
So it cuts both ways. And I think we've all benefited in one way or another. And I some of the detractors that were unwilling to come on the podcast, I think were afraid of the question that I just asked you. And that is, hey, we probably all were helped by somebody way back in the day. And you know, maybe that's part of it right there. We need to pay it forward a little bit more. But, you know, you work with Quail Forever, and then you see this discussion on Facebook every day. Are there certain places you wouldn't take somebody or send somebody, and why?
No, not really. Actually, the place I carried friends of mine to this past weekend is probably one of the top three spots I hunt. And I just believe that upland hunting needs more hunters. It needs more, you know, help. Even sometimes when people post on Facebook, hey, I'm coming to Idaho, what do I do? I'm not putting latitude and longitude out there, but I do try to say, hey, you know, look for rock outcroppings between 3,500 and 5,000 feet. Make sure there's some cheek grass, bunch grass around, and maybe a little bit of water close by. I try to help them get an idea on where to go, even though I don't know them from Adam's house cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that Adam's house cat is a good or bad thing. But
yeah. Don't get me started on cats. I'm a wire hair owner.
Yeah. I'm a griff owner. So I'm with
okay,
you.
Yeah. So, okay. So, do you have a vetting process for these people before you start sharing information? Do you at least find out if there's, I hate to use the term sportsman or not, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if I'm going to share a spot with somebody, Scott, I either want to know them well, or else I want to be with them. I want to go with them. I want to hunt with them. I'm not going to just send somebody to, you know, I'm not going to put a pin on a on an Onyx map and send it to somebody. That to me is, you know, just, I mean, I guess I'm just uncomfortable with the fact that whether or not they could even maybe get to where I'm trying to send them to.
I know that feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to discourage somebody, and I'm not trying to be in any way. I think you can tell by my attitude, I'm not in any way, shape, form, or fashion trying to conceal where I hunt, because I just don't think that's the answer to upland hunting.
I agree. But that's not my job today. My job is to find out what you think.
Yeah.
I think what I'm hearing is it's all a matter of degree. On your Facebook page, are you doing anything to discourage or encourage sharing offline, if you will?
No, I really don't. The only thing that obviously Facebook doesn't like the selling, you know, of dogs and stuff like that. So I try to discourage that, but no, I really haven't had that problem. Scott, the upland, upland bird hunters has been really pretty, I've just got like 1,000 followers. It's not huge, you know, it's right at 1,000. So, but again, I haven't run into a situation where, you know, people are hot spotting or anything like that. And again, if that happened, I mean, I might say, be careful with this. I mean, gosh, it's not, you know, but again, I'm the situation, because I know you're you're in Oregon, right?
Except when I'm in Idaho.
Yeah. but you know, we've got so much public land out here. I'm sure things are different, maybe, you know, even where I grew up in Georgia, you know, I mean, it's private land, but out here, there's so much public land. I just don't think it's beneficial to our sport to not be willing to try to help somebody that, you know, it may even be somebody from back east that's coming out west to hunt chuckers for the first time.
Yeah, they
man, I want them to have a great time
until their knees give out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, all in right. My case, my inseam's about 27 and a half inches. So, and I'm 67 years old, so I know my days are numbered.
Oh, I doubt it, Mark. Hey, great to talk with you about all of that stuff. And watch out, someday I'll warn you ahead of time if I'm coming your way. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate the call, buddy. Have a good evening.
Well, I can tell you one thing, that discussion will be going on long into the night in my head and maybe in yours as well. And if you want to carry on the discussion, go to the Upland Nation Facebook page or to the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. Glad to entertain your notions of what's right and what's not so right and why. You know, anybody can say no or hell no, but I'd love to have a rationale for whatever your opinion is. Thanks a lot for listening. And right now, let's talk about Dogtra and the TNB Dual brand new electric transmitter, collar, beeper. You know, I love mine. And when I was in South Dakota hunting at the Grand Seal Lodge with the Brock Francais we talked about earlier, we had a lot of times when those birds were running into unharvested bean fields. And when we had a pair of Brocks out there, we knew which dog was which dog, and we could monitor those dogs and we could handle those dogs, because it's so easy to go from dog A to dog B without having to look at the screen, without having to toggle back and forth. Two collars, one transmitter, one set of buttons for dog A, another set of buttons right there next to it for dog B. Remember, free shipping on any purchase over $200 and another 10% off any purchase over $200 if you use the code SLUN10. Dogtra.com is where I go for my training collars. It may be a cliche, but it's true. This land is your land. It's my land as well. You know my love for what we'll call the Great Basin out here in the West. One of the many reasons I love it so much is it's public. The Bureau of Land Management handles most of that management out there, especially north of Reno, way north of Reno. You may not have heard of the town of Gerlach, but you've heard of the Burning Man Festival. It's all out in that country that is full of what they call basin and range. Little mountain ranges, big flat basins, a lot of dry lake beds and desert country, which is just perfect for chuckers and valley quail. That whole area has the moniker Black Rock Desert, and it is. And you'll have to work hard to find those birds, but luckily Nevada's Department of Wildlife Management does a pretty good job of tracking their population dynamics, and you can get that information on their website. Learn your way around the area, learn the names of the mountain ranges, and all of a sudden you're good to go. Be careful, look for rocky outcroppings, find draws with water, and you'll probably find at least a starting point out there. If you're looking for a little bit more, check for those what they call alluvial slopes that have cheatgrass on them. Alluvial simply means that's where the prehistoric water washed a whole bunch of soil down off of mountains. When you're done checking out the Black Rock Desert, head back to Gerlach and have a drink at Bruno's Country Club and toast him for us. Rest in peace, Bruno, and thank you for your hospitality. And welcome again to our newest sponsor, Tag Safari. TagSafari.com is where you learn more about their discount for you. T-A-G Linden 15 will get you 15% off anything on the website. I've admired their stuff for years, particularly their, I'll call it Upland clothing, but now they've gone all the way and they've got some vests and some shirts and even some pants that work great in the uplands. And their safari jacket is my go-to dress-up jacket these days. I'll be giving a speech in Dodge City, Kansas on Saturday night. And I will be wearing that as opposed to, you know, some of the sport coats and things like that that other people might be wearing because they don't have any choice. Remember the code TAGLINDEN15 and you'll get 15% off any purchase. TAGSafari.com. And thanks again to Dogtra and their T&B Duel for making my last South Dakota visit so productive. Remember that you can get 10% off just about anything over $200, including that T&B dual collar and beeper combination. Just use the code SLUN10. Getting down to the bitter end here at the Upland Nation podcast. Appreciate your listening. Time for the Upland Trivia Quiz. This week's prize, a Sage and Breaker Mercantile gun, tool, and pick roll. Here's the question. In England, the red grouse season always opens way earlier than it does for most of us, and they call it the glorious blank. It's a number. What is the number? The glorious blank. If you have the answer, go to scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com and email it to me there. And while you're there, feel free to comment on the podcast. Tell your friends if you like it. Tell me if you don't, if you got suggestions, ideas, ways to improve it, want to be on the podcast, scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. Would appreciate your leaving a review and some comments, however you listen to your podcasts. And stay tuned for all the news about the Upland Nation podcast at the Upland Nation Facebook page, uplandnation.com, and also at the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. Hey, I hope you're having a great season. Maybe I'll see you in the field. Until then, be safe. Have a great one.